I'd like to continue talking a little bit more about mindfulness and the practice of Satipatthana, and taking up some of the threads that I mentioned a little bit earlier. So of course, mindfulness or sati is this quality which the Buddha said to be developed, and is one of the very central qualities in Buddhism. It's not the whole thing, but it's always there in the Eightfold Path. The seventh factor of the Eightfold Path is mindfulness. The third factor in the five spiritual faculties is mindfulness. Wherever we look in all the different frameworks and teachings that the Buddha gave on meditation, mindfulness is always one of the important ones. And mindfulness is applied or is useful in many different contexts. And if we look around the various places where the Buddha talked about mindfulness, you can see that he said that it was useful for everything from the very beginnings of spiritual practice, in terms of mindfulness as recollection, remembering the teachings. So this is a practice of mindfulness. Yeah, in those days, the Buddha would give a Dhamma talk, and everyone would go away and they'd remember it. How many people here are going to remember the talk from tonight? Maybe it's just not very memorable. But it's a quality that we've really lost, haven't we? Yeah? We don't train our memory to be able to remember things in that way. Yeah? That's something I know a little bit about as a musician, because you know that's where you do train yourself to be able to remember songs and remember pieces of music and so on. So this is one aspect of mindfulness. Another one is mindfulness, of course, is very useful in keeping sila, in ethical conduct. Because mindfulness, you know, we're aware of what we're doing. We're conscious of what's happening, what we're actually doing with ourselves. And of course, that's why the opposite of that is when you drink or take drugs or something, and then we lose a sense of self-awareness, awareness of who we are and what we're doing. And so that's why, of course, you always find that the more people drink and the more people take drugs, and the more their sila declines, the more their standard of morality and ethics declines. And so you can see that in many different cases, the coincidence of, say, domestic violence with use of alcohol, for example, is just one very obvious case where so many times people who would never commit an act of violence or hurt in that way when they're sober, and then once they get a few drinks into them, brings out the devil in them, and they do things that are really quite terrible. And in addition to those, mindfulness is essential in, as I was talking a little bit earlier, in this idea of the full awareness of one's postures and one's activities. Bringing a sense of consciousness, awareness to what we're doing. And that kind of awareness is a way always of coming back to what's actually happening. Living life actually here. And doing that even in the most mundane settings. Because normally what happens is that we spend our life looking forward to some things and regretting other things. And so we're kind of on this journey where we're constantly, like we're walking along the footpath, and we're constantly either thinking about where we're going to get to or where we've been or something else. And so mindfulness is a realization that actually right here and now, walking along the most boring footpath in the world, sitting in a car at a traffic jam, being stuck in an elevator, wherever we are, whatever we're doing, that's life, actually, right there, and it's just as important as any other moment. So when we start to valorize to each moment, to treat each moment as it happens, as if it was real and important, because it is. It is real and important. When we treat each moment like that, and then we get a great deal of contentment. We're not kind of rushing off to the future and the past and so on. The mind becomes much more settled. So this also is a very important aspect of mindfulness, to bring us into the here and now. But by far the most important use of mindfulness in Buddhism is in meditation. And that's by far the most characteristic place the Buddha talked about mindfulness. And so for this evening I want to talk a little bit more about what the Buddha was actually saying when he talked about applying mindfulness in meditation. So the basic passage, most fundamental passage, says this, that the meditator has gone to the forest, gone to the root of a tree, gone to an empty place. So most of us have, most of the time we've kind of failed that first step, haven't we? You go to a room or a crowded meditation hall or something like that. Yeah, it's not what the Buddha said, actually. Yeah, we think, oh, we can skip over those bits. We just won't worry about that. We'll just go on to the next part. Yeah, and then you wonder why it doesn't work. Yeah, well, it doesn't work for a very good reason, because there's a reason for that. There's a reason for going to the forest, or to sit at the root of a tree, or in a cave, or an empty place, because it's very peaceful. So yes, it's possible to contemplate and to practice mindfulness no matter what's happening, even if you're on a busy street or whatever. Of course it's possible. But it's much better if you can do it in a quiet place. So at the very least, if we can make a corner of our house, a shrine room, or at least a corner of a room that's set up for our meditation, then that's a really good thing to do. Even better if we can find a local park or a beach or something like that. Go and meditate there, meditate in the early morning on the beach or something like that. It's a very beautiful thing to do. So this is that first stage, is finding a peaceful and quiet place to meditate. And then it says you sit down cross-legged, set the back straight, and breathe mindfully in and out. So sato wa asasati, sato wa asasati. So it's the practice of satipatthana, and the Buddha always said that one, the very beginning of meditation, one establishes mindfulness. Actually, this word that we use, satipatthana, we translate as the establishment of mindfulness or foundation of mindfulness or something, actually just means meditation. Really, that's almost like the best way to translate it. Yeah, it just means to meditate. Go on to the root of a tree, sit down to meditate. That's how you say it in ordinary English language. Sometimes we forget that, or at least I forget that. You get so involved in the Buddhist texts, we end up using what we sometimes call Buddhist hybrid English, and it's not a kind of real language that people speak. It's just a language that Buddhist scholars use. So we try to translate, what's the best way of translating satipatthana, to establish mindfulness. Actually, the best way to translate it is just to do meditation. Sits down to meditate. Now that meditation, of course, can be many different objects of meditation, and I won't go into all the different objects, but just for now, just look at consider the example of the breath meditation, which we were doing earlier. So it says one establishes mindfulness on the breath going in and breath going out. So sato va asasati, sato pasasati. Mindful and brings in, mindful and brings out. Now the crucial thing here, the most important aspect of how we do this, how we begin the meditation, is what is the subjective attitude? What are the qualities that we bring to the meditation? What are the qualities we bring to the breath? What is the manner that we pay attention to the breath? This is the most important thing, and it's the hardest thing to convey. Often when we teach meditation, it's easy to teach the objective side of meditation. We can teach, you know, you pay attention to the breath, you count with the breath, count one on the in-breath and one on the out-breath, two on the second breath, two on the second out-breath, and so on up to nine, and then you count back to one again. So we can teach a counting method, or we can say you do buddho with the breath or something like that. So these are all the externals of the practice, the objects of the meditation. But that really critical thing is not those all those techniques. You can use any of those techniques, they're all fine. But the critical thing is what is that subjective quality of mind that we bring to the meditation? What is the manner that we bring to the meditation? So one of those subjective qualities is something we've already learnt from the sutta reading we heard a little bit earlier, the story of Sona, is neither pushing too hard nor too lax. Evenness of effort. Yeah? This is actually the first quality that the Buddha mentioned in the context of Satipatthana, is he used the word atapi. Okay, that means that vigilant or diligent, practicing with a kind of evenness of effort. So atapi means that one keeps on applying oneself with a certain degree of edge in the practice, but not with a too pushing. So when I say a certain degree of edge, I mean that there has to be a certain vibrancy to it. There has to be a certain zing when we're doing the meditation. Otherwise, sometimes it's very easy to just drift, get kind of bored and complacent. So I think you know what I mean when I'm talking about that kind of edge, that kind of slightly kind of fresh. A newness to the meditation. Keep on reapplying. So like every moment is fresh, every moment is new. So we keep that slight bit of edge in there. And the thing that sustains that, that underlies and sustains that sense of energy is our own urgency. Okay, it's our own understanding that we're actually here to do something very important. Actually, this meditation is incredibly significant. This is something which is not—it's not just a way of passing the time. It's not just a way of getting, you know, a little bit peaceful, or you know, being able to let go of my anger or something like that. All of which is important, but the meditation is actually about something far more than that. It's about uncovering the very nature of the mind. It's about understanding where suffering arises. It's about getting to the roots of the ignorance and delusion which keeps on making me cause suffering for myself and suffering for others. And if we're going to do anything in this life, actually this is the most worthwhile thing we can do. If we can succeed in doing this and really kind of uncoil that tangle that's giving rise to suffering, and everything else in our life will have so much more quality and depth. So if we reflect that way, reflect that actually our life's impermanent, reflect that We don't know when we're going to die. We may be old, we may be young, but for all of us, this day could be our last. This breath could be our last. So if we're taking the time to sit here and meditate, let's make sure that every breath counts. Every moment counts. So this is that quality of atapi, the evenness of energy, which comes from a reflective sense of like the urgency and the significance of the path that we're practicing. The second of the subjective qualities that the Buddha talked about in the context of Satipatthana was sampajana. Sampajanya means, it really means usually translated as full awareness or clear comprehension. Probably clear comprehension is probably the best translation. But what it means is a kind of an all-round understanding. Okay, it means an understanding of context. It means you know what's the purpose of what we're doing. Now, I learned that lesson just after my first retreat. The first retreat I did was in Thailand, and I did the retreat in this monastery, Wat Rampung, in Chiang Mai. And it was nearly a month of intensive meditation. After the retreat finished, 1 or 2 days later, they asked the yogis if they would give a hand doing a little bit of work in the monastery. Actually, it was just a very small thing. But they demolished a little hut, and they wanted to move the timbers from one place to another. And so they got us to give a hand. And when we went to do this, I was very, very aware. I thought to myself, this is the first thing that I've done as a meditator. Because during the retreat, you're just meditating, right? When you go to the toilet and you eat your meal and stuff like that. But this is the first piece of work or something else that I've done. And so I thought, okay, this is great. This is a chance for me to practice mindfulness. Make sure I don't lose my mindfulness. Make sure I keep aware of everything. So we went to this building site. And of course, it's Thailand and it's the hot season. So you're just sort of wearing these cheap rubber flip-flops and stuff. There's no kind of OH&S or anything ridiculous like that. So there we are. And I remember reminding myself, right, very clearly, be mindful every step. Whatever you do, be mindful. I took one step into the building site and trod on a rusty nail. Piece of wood, big nail, right through into my foot. Bingo. First step. I knew I was perfectly mindful. Lifting my foot's going up, foot's going along, foot's going right down on a nail. Yeah? I knew, absolutely. This is my foot, this is a nail. My nail is in my foot. Yeah? So there was like mindfulness, but no sampajanya, no clear comprehension, yeah? So clear comprehension has got that kind of broadness about it, yeah? So sometimes and clear comprehension is the one that understands that there are different ways of applying your mind in different contexts. Yeah? That's something I didn't know that, because the way that I've been applying my mind in the retreat was always in that kind of very kind of fine things, you know, just moving a hand to pick up a glass of water and pick it up. And so it's like a training. So you're training yourself, yeah, to be very slow and very careful. Every movement, and try to be aware. Anytime if you catch yourself picking up a glass of water without thinking, and then you think, hang on, no, stop. Put it down again. Now practice. I lost my mindfulness, I have to do it again. So you kind of practice like that. There's actually a story in the Buddhist scriptures about that. There's one monk who used to live in a cave, and he used to walk a long distance into the village for alms every morning. He'd walk for about an hour to get to the village for alms, and he was doing this practice. So he'd walk and he'd be mindful of every step. And but he did his practice that if he ever lost his mindfulness while he was walking in, he'd go back and retrace it again from the point that he lost his mindfulness. Yeah? He'd be walking. My mind drifted back at the creek back there, so we'd have to go back to the creek and then pick it up again and keep on going. So if you, that's a very good practice, yeah? Because it's, if you, you know this good, as a monk, one thing is that, of course, you know, you haven't eaten since yesterday, right? So you're pretty hungry. So it's normal for the mind to get a bit excited because you're going into meal. You know, you're really hungry, so you're really looking forward to it. And then you're really motivated to keep your mindfulness, because if you lose your mindfulness too often, you're not going to get it into the village by the time noon comes along. And then you... So it's a very good practice. So this is how I learnt that difference, yeah? So this is that sampajanya, it's a clear comprehension. You understand? Well, there are different ways of being in different contexts. And this is something that people always say when they're on retreat, you know, how do I keep this kind of mindfulness after I've left the retreat? And the answer is you shouldn't, yeah? You're supposed to have different kinds of awareness and mindfulness outside of retreat than on retreat. That's why you have retreats, yeah? If you're going to be able to keep the same level of mindfulness outside retreat, then why bother going to the retreat in the first place? So it's quite appropriate. You need to learn to do things in different ways in different contexts. This is why Ajahn Chah was in the Thai forest tradition. They're never so thrilled about doing the kind of specialized practices for developing mindfulness, but they're much more just be natural, whatever you do. Yeah, so they don't do kind of like, you know, detailed eating mindfully practices and these kinds of things. But just be natural, everything you do. But just kind of watch it. Yeah? Just be aware. Yeah? Just understand what's going on. Atapi sampajana satima, the third quality is mindfulness itself. And basically what mindfulness is about is continuity. Mindfulness literally means memory. So if we ask ourselves, what does memory do? Well, basically what memory does is it knits the past and the present together, doesn't it? Yeah? It gives a sense of continuity between here we are, well, this is what I'm doing now, and things that I've done in the past. We can remember there's a connection. So this is what mindfulness does when it comes into meditation, is it makes a connection, a continuity in our practice. So when we're watching the breath, the Pali word we have is anapanasati. And again, usually we translate that as the kind of Buddhist hybrid English phrase is mindfulness of breathing. The Venerable Tanisara translates it much better. He translates it as keeping the breath in mind. Yeah, and that's a fantastic translation of that, keeping the breath in mind. That's exactly what anapanasati means, keeping the breath in mind. So there's this sense of mindfulness has this sense of holding and continuity to it. In the yogic tradition, in the Yoga Sutra, they don't use the word mindfulness. They use another word, that word dharana. And dharana also means memory, but the literal meaning of dharana is to uphold something or to bear something. So that carries that meaning even more explicitly, even more clearly, that mindfulness... The purpose of mindfulness is to uphold, to keep that thing, to keep that continuity, to keep that awareness, keeping the breath in mind. And the last quality that the Buddha mentioned with these things was vinaya loke abhijja domana sang, which means having dispelled covetousness and grief for the world. And what this effectively means is that it means that by the time it's referring to the practices that we do before we come to sit meditation, and that we're keeping precepts, we're keeping sila, we're living a good life, we're not harming others, that we're practicing with contentment and restraint and all of those other things. Right? So it's reminding us that we can't. Expect to, you know, can't divorce meditation from how we live the rest of our life. And what all of those practices do is that they give us a certain degree of mental stability, and especially emotional stability. So these two words, abhijadomanasam, translated as covetousness and grief. And so these are like strong forms of attachment and strong forms of displeasure or dislike of things. That's not saying that you have to sort of, you know, be completely free of any of these things before you start to meditate. It's just saying that when you come to meditate, that you should have a certain, you know, we try to have like a certain degree of equanimity and a feeling of letting go of these things. And I'm sure if you've ever tried to meditate, you know, if you haven't done these things, then it's really hard, isn't it? Yeah, if you're feeling really angry, and you know, it's even the idea of meditating when you're feeling really angry, it's just repulsive, isn't it? Yeah, you just don't want to be with yourself, yeah? And you kind of sit there and just make it worse. So this is why this idea that we should try to take care of our mind all the time, yeah? Through practicing all of those good things that the Buddha taught, so that when the time comes to meditate, our minds have a reasonable degree of stability and equanimity. So this is the four qualities, the subjective side of meditation that we bring, and we should bring these to whatever meditation that we're doing. Now, in terms of the objects of meditation, we've been talking about the breath. Of course, it's the most important. There are many other ways of doing satipatthana meditation, but the breath is the most important. So, this is practiced in four major stages: body, feeling, mind, and dhammas. And I won't go into these in too much detail, but I'll just talk a little bit about what each of these four are and how they relate to the breath. So the first one, body contemplation, I already talked a little bit about earlier, and it's this idea that we can establish and ground our mind, our awareness, through bringing attention and focusing on our body. And not only does this give us a more stable place to pay attention to and to develop meditation, but it actually is a force of healing and of bringing together the mind and the body. Integrating is the psychological jargon that we use these days, but integrating the mind and the body. That's what you're doing, yeah? So in psychology, you talk about integration all the time. That's precisely what it is. You sit down there, you pay attention to what's happening in your body. That's integration. That's happening right there. So in breath meditation, we talked earlier about the four steps of breath meditation, which are primarily the four stages of the development of the contemplation of the body, is the long breath, the short breath, the whole breath, and the tranquil breath. Now, in all of those stages, our main object, our main focus of awareness, is the actual physical feeling of the breath itself. This is why it comes under body contemplation. We're aware of the actual air, the physical touch of the breath. Now, the way that appears to different people is different. Most people will focus on the tip of the nose, and you feel the flow of the stream of air as it's coming in and out. But different people will be aware of the breath in different ways, and it can work. Some people prefer to pay attention to the sense of the whole body breathing, or some people watch the rise and fall of the abdomen. And different ways of paying attention. It doesn't matter too much. The only qualification I would make there is that, you know, if you're paying attention in different ways, just think about the way that manner of focusing the mind will affect the mind itself. So, for example, if you're paying attention to the breath at the tip of the nose, that tends to be quite peaceful and quite a cool way of paying attention. Yeah, it's slightly disconnected. Slightly objective? No, that's not the right word. Slightly detached. Yes, thank you. Thank you, Alex. Excellent. Slightly detached because it's sort of at the edge there. And so that's one of the things that means is when you're paying attention to the breath there, is that you tend to not get so caught up in your emotional issues and emotional stuff which is going on. You can still be aware of it, still reflected in the breath, but you're not so caught up in it. If you watch the breath, say, in the belly, right before the abdomen, then you're right down in the guts, yeah? So that's where all your kind of emotions and stuff are held, especially a lot of the very coarse ones, you know, you can feel in there. So that's not to say it's better or worse, but it's just saying that when you do that, then you observe that these things can sometimes have those different effects on the mind. Or again, if you focus on a very tight spot, you pay attention at like one narrow point in meditation, then that helps you to focus, it helps you to concentrate, yeah? But it can sometimes make the mind a bit tight and a bit forced. So then, alternatively, you can pay attention to the sensation of the whole body, a very broadly focused awareness, and then the mind can be much more relaxed and much more at ease. But then the downside is that can sometimes make the mind a bit more woofly, a bit more vague. Our concentration isn't so sharp and so precise. So what that means is that as you become experienced in meditation, then you can learn at different times. It's useful to pay attention in different ways because it will influence the mind in a different way. And so this is like understanding the nature of the character of your own mind, that you'll know what's the best way to do it at that particular time. And again, this is the sampajanya, the clear comprehension, which is operating here. So if we practice with knowing the breath, experiencing the breath, tranquilizing the breath, at a certain point in time, as the breath becomes tranquil, we'll begin to notice these various feelings that arise within the breath. And feelings, initially, the breath is very equanimous, it just feels quite neutral, doesn't have much feeling tone to it. But at a certain point, as the breath becomes peaceful and the mind becomes peaceful, then a certain quality of joy arises, joy and happiness. It can happen very suddenly, it can happen very slowly, it can take different forms. But that joy will, and sometimes we'll experience that joy in the body. We have various kinds of like a sense of thrill or electricity or something in the body. Sometimes a sense of joy will, the best way to experience it is when it wells up inside the breath itself. It's the most unified, most integrated experience of it. And so as that happens, we're starting to experience the breath transforming itself. We're starting to move from the body contemplation to the next one of the four satipatthanas, which is the contemplation of feelings, yeah. So we're starting to be aware of these pleasant, very joyful feelings associated with the breath. And together with those feelings, usually comes some kind of light, some kind of perception of light. We call nimitta. In the initial stages of meditation, that nimitta will be fairly unstable or fairly dim, and then later on, as the concentration gets better, the nimitta will become more bright and more stable. But in any case, in breath meditation, don't pay attention to the nimitta. Okay, ignore it. Right? Because when the light first appears in the mind, it's quite distracting. It's very attractive. We want to pay attention to it. When we move our mind to watch it, then we get distracted and our concentration falls away. So just ignore it. The real nimitta, it's not something that you can actually watch, really. The real nimitta is something which fills your whole mind. Yeah? It comes up inside the breath and fills your whole mind so that you don't have any choice about whether to watch it or not. It's like walking into a midday sun and ask yourself the question, you know, can I be aware of the light or not? Well, you don't have any choice. It's there. When you close your eyes, it doesn't go away. So this is a contemplation of feelings. And it's developing that sense of very subtle, tranquil, steeped sense of pleasure throughout the body and which soaks through the breath. And the next section is contemplation of mind. And the contemplation of mind refers to the understanding of the quality of the nature of awareness. So that means we understand whether our mind is knowing clearly or not. Okay, so when our mind is affected by various kinds of afflictions, greed, hatred, and delusion, and so on, then the mind becomes contracted, or it becomes hard, or it becomes unclear. We don't know well. And as the mind becomes more and more pure in meditation, the power of knowing becomes more pure. We see with clarity. And as we see with clarity, we begin to understand what the nature of the mind is itself. Now this contemplation, the cittanupassana or contemplation of the mind, we can get glimpses of that. We can get a feeling for it, an intuition for it. But it's not until we've really begun to experience some deep states of meditation, some sense of clarity, that we have a point of contrast and we can understand how, you know, dirty and unclean and incompetent our ordinary state of consciousness is. And this is one of the amazing things about meditation, is that the more you purify your mind and the more you come to a state of brilliant and clear awareness, the more natural it seems. And it's, even though it's a very kind of exotic state of mind, it actually feels like coming home. It feels completely natural. And you realize that actually it's our ordinary everyday consciousness which is quite unnatural. So this is one of the really true signs true concentration, is that it feels completely natural. So this is the contemplation of mind, and then the final one of the four satipatthanas is the contemplation of dhammas. Now what this contemplation of dhammas means essentially is that one understands and reflects on, it's a reflective practice of understanding causes and conditions. So understanding what is the things that are helping meditation, what are the things that are opposing it. So when we do the guided meditation here, and as we did this evening, and we do every time we do the guided meditation, at the end of the practice we do a little bit of reflection. Yeah, back over the meditation, how did that go, what happened, what was useful, what was not useful, and so on. And that's the very beginning, it's like the baby form of what this contemplation of dhammas is about. It's about reflecting back over the process of meditation and understanding, why did the mind become peaceful? It's an absolutely crucial point. Why did the mind become peaceful? In understanding that, we're understanding the very nature of the mind itself. And that's what it's all about. So through this contemplation of dhammas, and then when we understand what that process is, then the process will become much more reliable. You know, we can because we know what the process is, it's not a matter of chance anymore. When we sit down to meditate, we know how to use our mind in what way to counter these particular problems or to take advantage of these good qualities. What's the best way to use our mind at this time, and to bring our mind to peacefulness and to stillness. So this is the beginning of developing what they call insight or vipassana in meditation. And so this is something which emerges during this fourth satipatthana, the dhammanupassana. And one of the lovely things about this practice of satipatthana is that it's very, very natural. And I tried to bring that out when we were doing the guided meditation a little bit earlier, and you can see that the four stages that we went through, the long breath, the short breath, the whole breath, and the tranquil breath, each one in a sense is, it's just how the breath goes. Yeah? It's just a description of how the meditation actually goes. We're just like learning to notice the nature of what happens as the breath becomes peaceful. So it's not like forcing a program onto the breath. It's not like making you practice in this way or that way, but it's learning to understand. And so the whole practice of Satipatthana is like that. It's actually just the way that the mind works. We understand that process. And that the description of the four Satipatthanas is like a reflection of that, which helps us to bring it to mind and to be more clear. So the outcome or the purpose of the Satipatthana, as it says in the phrase that I said at the beginning, Ekayano ayam bhikkhave maggo, is that the Satipatthana is the way of Ekayana, which means that coming all together as one. Okay, so Ekayana is coming, is like convergence, all coming together as one. So through the practice of Satipatthana, everything comes together as one. The mind and our body come together as one. The feelings come together as one. Consciousness comes together. Understanding comes together. Everything comes together in a sense of balance. And from there, this is where we develop the deep insight that leads to liberation, leads to Nibbana. So this is my little talk for you this evening on the four Satipatthanas. And I offer that for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments and questions.
Yeah, I would like to comment. Interesting how the Satipatthana is structured in these four meditations or contemplations. And it reminds me, when we study in science ecology, we don't start straight as ecology, we build foundation. We actually study anatomy and physiology of the species, we study, and then we put it together. Everything in ecology. And so it reminds me, we study the body, the feelings, the mind, and then we have these holistic meditations. We see the hindrances, the dependent origination, all these processes, and to see that it's dependent on observation of those previous.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. It's the same process, yeah. So that's exactly what Dhammanupassana is, the contemplation of Dhammas. It's understanding the whole of it, understanding the relationships between the connections between it. Yeah. Absolutely.
Bhante, I was always a little bit confused in the contemplation of the body part of Satipatthana, say as it is in the Satipatthana Sutta, that some of what was described there seemed to be like quite experiential. So say like the four elements, if you just sat down and paid attention to the body.
Yeah.
But other ones seem to be quite complex and abstracted. So if you, you know, and the things that you can't actually experience, like if you say the body is made up of, you know, like the beans, the bag of beans, similarly, or if you did like a contemplation on the disintegration of the body.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's, I just found that a bit confusing. Like, what's the, they seem like quite different practices. What's the connection?
Well, they are different practices. And that they will all have an effect, you know, different effect in one way or another. But it's all, in a sense, it's all, you know, meant to be coming back home and sort of bringing it all back to this kind of experience that we have here. So, for example, like the parts of the body, one of the interesting things about the parts of the body is that they're often the things which you don't, you know, say like contemplation of the bones, right? It's one of the best ones. Well, normally we don't see our own bones. We don't really pay attention to them too much, you know. Only if you see a skeleton or something, you actually remind yourself that bones are. But if you contemplate it, you know, when you start, it's just an idea. But when you contemplate it more, you actually realize that, of course, you can experience your bones inside your body all the time. Actually, you feel the touch of your bones there, you know. And if you imagine what it would be like if you didn't have any bones. Yeah, you'd be like a blob on the ground, right, twitching, yeah, you took all your bones out. Yeah? So actually, that's the difference. That's why there's a hardness in our spine, yeah, that's why you can feel a solidity. And you can actually experience those by paying close attention inside your body. So a lot of those things, okay, some of them may be a bit more obscure, like the spleen or something like that. I haven't had a direct experience of that. But certainly many of them, you can actually learn to really kind of experience what they feel like. So there's these kind of two aspects. One of them is like an aspect of what we call perception or sanya, which is like a sort of imagining what they're like. and then the other is the experience. But, you know, in both cases, it's always going towards that sort of direct realization of it. Yeah. But those different ways of doing it are useful for different characters as well. The general distinction is that people who have a better visual imagination will do better using the kind of the parts of the body and various visual kinds of things, whereas those who may be more experiential would be better maybe contemplating the four elements or something like that.
Yeah. So mindfulness being the path to the deathless, could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's not really. Well, it's mistranslation. The Pali is apamado amatankarang, is that diligence or heedfulness is the path to the deathless, which is a slightly different thing. Yeah. So that's actually not talking about mindfulness as such. Actually, the word heedfulness or pamada, it's associated with mindfulness, but it's also closely associated with energy and with diligence. So basically, it means what that phrase really means is that it's through not neglecting the practice and through a kind of sincere and sustained effort in doing the path, practicing the path. This is what the way to the deathless is. Funny how these phrases get into the culture.
Okay. How do you suggest we contemplate the body, various practices such as contemplate the skeleton or various stages of decomposition of the body?
Mm-hmm.
Should we focus on the breath to start with and get to a certain level of
the breath is the most important one, and that's the one that the Buddha, you know, taught by far the most often and with the most emphasis. And the breath by itself is good enough to reach Nibbana. Okay, so you can practice breath meditation and become an arahant. No problems. You don't have to do anything else, right? So those other practices are more kind of specific, and they can be helpful for some people at some times, but they're not so kind of universal. So the best thing is if you're doing breath meditation and to sort of, you know, see to keep that as your main practice, and then if you'd like to play around with some of the other ones and experiment with them and see where they lead you, and if you find you get good results from them, terrific. You know, you can do them as much as you like, but if you find that the breath is more beneficial for you, then just stick with that, and it's not a problem.
I sometimes find that if I really don't feel like meditating, sometimes body contemplation is a good one because I don't know, for some reason it's just easier, I guess.
Because it's not real meditation.
No, it's like a. I don't know, it's sort of like the easy option.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
If you really don't feel like it, you can do that instead, and you're still doing it, but you're not forcing yourself to kind of focus on the brain.
Yeah, fair enough, that's good. Yeah.
So a lot of people say, you know, they follow the breath in and out.
Uh-huh.
Is that too much movement?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I've never done that, but I guess it could be useful just like an initial stage to help you establish your mindfulness. But certainly if you're going to make the mind at all peaceful, then you shouldn't be following the breath in and out. Yeah.
So the main spot's just the tip of the nose, is it?
For most people, yeah.
Are there any spots where you should focus it?
Anywhere where it gives rise to unwholesome dhammas.
Oh,
okay. Doesn't it? Yeah, well, it's quite amazing actually. You find that if you focus on anywhere in your body, you can actually feel the breath there. You try it and see. Yeah?
Just in connection to an earlier question, you said those with like a visual imagination would be better to contemplate the body parts.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And the others that are not so visual, to perhaps contemplate the four elements.
Yeah.
Could you please elucidate the four elements?
Oh, so the four elements, earth, water, wind and fire. So they're more kind of experiential in terms of how you experience them in your body. So the earth is the solidity. So when you feel the, like the hardness of the bones and the solidity of the flesh and so on, then this is you're experiencing the earth element. So you can just kind of sit there and then just feel, okay, in your hands, you just feel the hardness of those. And just go through the different parts of the body and just be aware directly of that sensation. Similarly with the water, you can start with the most obvious example of water is usually the saliva you can feel in your mouth. And you feel, well, there's an obvious example of water, and then you can look in different places, in your eyes, yeah, or inside your body, the experience of water. Air, obviously, the most obvious one is the movement of the breath in and out, but you can also feel the air on your skin moving around. And also the air refers to any of the energies which are moving around inside your body on a more subtle level. Yeah? So you can feel these kind of different airs. Fire, of course, the temperature. Yeah? So you can actually feel the temperature. You can feel the different parts of the body have a different temperature. Some parts will be warm, some parts cool, and so on. And so you could just start out with each one in turn, And investigate that, reflect on it, look at it in every different part of your body until that becomes really clear. So do that with the earth and then go to the water and then investigate each water until that's very clear, and then with the air and that's very clear and so on. And as you do that, then the quality, the characteristic of each element becomes very apparent to you. And so you begin to understand how actually the physics, because of course these, in terms of what we learned at, you know, high school physics, this is just the different states of matter, isn't it? Solid, liquid, gas, and heat is the element which transforms one from one to the other. Yeah? It's just the basic states of matter. And so you're just kind of learning to experience that. This is what the material world is made up of.
What about space and consciousness?
Oh, that's getting some more cool stuff. Yeah. In terms of...
They're the extra two elements, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, so they're sometimes treated as the extra two elements. Yeah, you can also contemplate the space inside your body. Again, you start out with the space in your mouth and just the emptiness there. And then you can just contemplate the different space in the ears and so on, different place in the body. Maybe if you haven't eaten, then you've got empty space in your belly. And consciousness, again, you could just concentrate. That's just similar to the Cittanupassana, just contemplating the nature of mind. Okay, so we should probably wrap up there. It's getting a little bit late. Okay, let's finish my thing.